Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It is 7 a.m. in Shanghai, 10 a.m. in Sydney, and 6 p.m. here in Atlanta. I'm Linda Kincaid, and for Julia Chatterley, wherever you are in the world, this is your First Move. A very warm welcome to First Move. Here's your need to know. U.S. President Joe Biden prepares to deliver his final State of the Union before the 2024 election. We're told he'll direct the military to build a port to deliver aid into Gaza. The UN warns the territory is on the brink of famine. Also in Haiti, the government extends its state of emergency as the capital continues its descent into gang violence. All that coming up. But first, in just 3 hours, U.S. President Joe Biden will deliver his State of the Union address to Congress and the American people. It could have a major impact on the course of the 2024 presidential election. The president's speech is expected to lay out his plans for the U.S. economy. It's likely to include higher taxes for corporations and the rich. He's also expected to address the Israel-Hamas conflict and reveal plans for the construction of a port in Gaza for humanitarian aid. It's also a chance for him to push back against critics who say he's too old for office. During the speech, Donald Trump is planning his own brand of counter-programming. He's promising a live play-by-play rebuttal of Mr. Biden's remarks. Ron Brownstein is a CNN senior political analyst and a senior editor at The Atlantic. Good to have you with us, Ron.
Hey, good to be here.
So the president's State of the Union address tonight. But I want to ask, before we get to the content, I want to ask about the state of what we can expect when it comes to his passion, his vigor, his energy. Because at 81 years old, voters want to know if he's got what it takes to be fit for another term, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, look, 75 to 80% of Americans are consistently saying in polls, they don't think he has, in your phrase, what it takes for another term. He can't dispel that with a single speech. This is a pretty much of a safe zone for a politician. You know, there was unusual ad-libbing between him and Republicans last year on Social Security, but generally it's a pretty scripted affair. Those views about whether he is up to the job are probably going to have, if he is going to change him, it's really going to be kind of like sanding away, or scraping away at a glacier, and he's going to have to show it week after week in the way he conducts himself. In many ways, their best opportunity is not so much to change whether people think he's too old, but whether they think he is too out of touch, disconnected, whether he has plans to make their lives better. Those are the fronts, I think, where he can make more progress.
And in terms of making people's lives better, Ron, we know that economic populism is a major Biden platform, promoting the interests of all citizens, not just the wealthy, powerful elite. What can we expect when he talks about his economic agenda?
Yeah, I'm guessing, as you suggest, you're going to hear a heavy dose of economic populism paired with specific steps and policies that they have undertaken to try to make the cost of living more affordable and help families make ends meet. I mean, you know, they are facing, that is the biggest, I think, other than age, the biggest problem he faces, the cumulative increase in prices and in key essentials of life, particularly groceries and rent, since he took office. He has a bunch of specific policies he can point to, particularly in reducing prescription drug costs. Tonight, they're going to talk about it, creating a $2,000 out-of-pocket cap for all Americans on their prescription drug spending, Medicare negotiating with pharmaceutical companies to bring down drug costs, bigger subsidies to help people afford healthcare. I think you're going to see him propose higher taxes on the wealthy and corporation as a way of funding some of the things that were left out of Build Back Better. It became the Inflation Reduction Act, his big domestic policy agenda, and particularly an expanded child tax credit. So there are a variety of ways in which I think he is going to try to deal with what is probably his biggest domestic challenge, the anxiety among people, particularly around the median income or below, about how much prices has increased under his tenure.
And Ron, in terms of foreign policy, we have heard criticism about the U.S. sending in military aid to Israel without conditions. There are Democrats who see that continued support for the war as a political disaster. We know that the U.S. today is planning to build some sort of port to send in more humanitarian aid into Gaza. Will that be enough to turn the tide with voters who may have turned away?
Well, you know, the politics of this are complicated, right? Because on balance, more Americans still support backing Israel than not. It is the issue is, and certainly if you are looking for a president who is going to put more pressure and constraints on Benjamin Netanyahu, it's not Donald Trump. In fact, I think the evidence is pretty clear that Netanyahu would rather have Trump in the White House. But within the Democratic coalition, this clearly is an important wedge. And we have seen in Michigan, which is a state that Biden, I don't think, can win without, given what's happening in other places like Georgia. This is a real point of backlash. I mean, Biden has bound himself to a partner in Netanyahu who probably doesn't have his best interests at heart, who, as I say, would prefer in all likelihood that he'd be dealing with Trump on the other side of the table. So I am interested to see how far Biden goes on what seems to be an inevitable trajectory of having to break more decisively with Netanyahu, who has really given him very little and kind of stonewalled all of his requests for, in particular, kind of the diplomatic day after the war. I think you're going to see some breaking with him tonight, and I would predict it's not the last that we're going to see.
All right. We will be watching it closely 3 hours from now. Ron Brownstein, good to have you with us. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the U.S. has delivered its third airdrop of aid into Gaza this Thursday, and President Biden does plan to send in more. But hopes of a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas by the Muslim holy month of Ramadan are fading. A Hamas delegation left Cairo after days of talks without an obvious breakthrough. Egyptian state-run media says the negotiations will resume next week. Well, our Jeremy Diamond is in Tel Aviv covering the story for us and joins us now. Good to have you with us, Jeremy. So a ceasefire looking less and less likely, but the U.S. is trying to find a new way to go around Israel, which of course is its main ally in the Middle East, to get aid into Gaza, this time via sea.
Yeah, that's right. And this announcement is set to come in prime time during President Biden's State of the Union address. Very prominent billing for a big problem for Gazans, of course, in terms of the humanitarian situation, but also, of course, a very big political problem for Joe Biden, who has come under scrutiny for the U.S.'s close allyship to Israel and its inability so far to really ratchet up the pressure on Israel to solve this humanitarian disaster that is unfolding in Gaza. And so this announcement from the president is going to be to announce that the U.S. military is going to be building a floating port off the coast of Gaza in the Mediterranean Sea. It will include a temporary pier that will allow for hundreds of truckloads per day of humanitarian aid to be brought into Gaza. But of course, this is not an immediate term solution to the problem that is faced in Gaza. This is a longer term solution because it's going to take weeks, if not months, to actually build this port and get it up and running. And so in the meantime, the United States is continuing to airdrop aid. We also understand that they are bringing pressure to bear on Israel to open up an additional crossing point directly into northern Gaza via the land. And in fact, the United Nations, which praise Biden for carrying out this move, but also underscored the fact that it is only by land can the aid that needs to be brought in at the scale that it needs to be brought in, can it's only in that way that sufficient aid can actually be brought into Gaza. So an enormous challenge. And frankly, it is also kind of just an a way of underlining the fact that the United States has failed to bring sufficient pressure to bear to get Israel to open up the sufficient means necessary to get enough humanitarian aid into Gaza, despite all that the United States has done to support Israel. And so in taking these measures, whether it is the airdrops, whether it is opening up a port that will come in a matter of weeks, it really just underlines the fact that so far the efforts to bring in sufficient aid to Gaza have effectively failed, as more than 500,000 people are now on the brink of famine.
Yeah, a dire situation. Jeremy Dimon, we thank you for your reporting from Tel Aviv. Well, new developments in Ukraine now. The commander of Ukraine's land forces says Russia is concentrating its efforts in the eastern village of Avdiivka, which it took control of last month. He says Russian forces are now trying to push towards several towns in the Donetsk region. A regional official says Moscow is also ramping up attacks near villages in the Zaporizhia region in southern Ukraine. Well, Nick Payton Walsh is covering the story and joins us now live from Odessa. Good to have you there for us, Nick. So Russia, as I said, recently took this town and is now trying to advance further. This is U.S. aid is still being held up by Congress. What are you seeing and hearing on the ground?
Yeah, look, it's a perilous situation for Ukraine to the west of Avdiivka, a large town that well over a fortnight ago they withdrew from after persistent months of Russian pressure and battling with inside its city limits. But the picture has been very bleak for Kiev since then, because while they seem to have voluntarily decided to fall back quite far west from Avdiivka and try and hold a defensive line along three pretty small villages, Olivka, Berdichi and Tenenke, the Russians have come at them exceptionally hard. And while the public statements we've heard from Ukrainian military officials suggest that they are indeed holding those villages, there are some indications from pro-Ukrainian military bloggers that the situation inside those villages is very bleak indeed. Olivka particularly under threat. We weren't far from it last night and heard the intense explosions echoing around it, as Russia seems to be throwing extraordinary resources to try and take these three villages. Now, what's their significance? Strategically, almost nothing, you might argue, but once Russia has these in their hands, then the geography of the area potentially gives them a chance to leap forwards a reasonable distance and take a lot more ground off the Ukrainians. But more importantly, the fact that the Ukrainians can't hold what they declared was going to be their defensive line after Avdiivka raises the larger question about their strategy, their preparedness, their defensive lines, and how well thought through their future defense is. Coming back out of Avdiivka wasn't something necessarily that you couldn't have thought might have happened in a number of weeks, and the pressure Ukraine is experiencing also suggests a resurgent Russia, who potentially ahead of the elections later on this month might be trying to achieve some kind of breakthrough and may indeed be nearing it. Linda, you also mentioned Zaporizhia. Well, we were there a couple of weeks ago now to see the pressure Russia's putting on Robotyne. That was one of the key villages that Ukraine took, one of the only successes, frankly, of its summer counter-offensive. Now, they've been under intense Russian assault there. Often the Russians move in, get hit by the Ukrainians, try and flank the Ukrainians. There's a lot of pressure on Verbove to its east, another village of minimal significance but huge strategic use potentially, where Russia take it back off the Ukrainians. Talk there that while there were no attacks a few days ago, now there are well over a dozen. A sign again that Russia continues to hammer home, using an extraordinary number of troops and armor and resources, particularly aviation here, enormous guided gliding bombs that seem to hit Ukrainian targets relentlessly, that Russia is throwing everything it can really in a bid to try and get some kind of sustainable success along the front lines. I have to say, from what we've been seeing in the east, it does appear to be working. It is a bleak picture, and it's the lack of US aid, frankly, that is leaving Ukrainians wondering quite what their relief from this Russian onslaught is, Linda.
Yeah. A bleak picture indeed. Nick Payton Walsh, good to have you there on the ground for us in Odessa. Thank you very much. Well, Haiti's government has extended its state of emergency until next month. It comes as the nation's capital of Port-au-Prince continues to descend into gang violence. The country's prime minister landed in Puerto Rico earlier this week. Tens of thousands of people have left their homes, and the World Food Program has suspended much of its aid distribution across Haiti. That, of course, puts food security and medical care at risk. Our Patrick Ottman is covering this story and joins us from Havana. So, Patrick, this situation continues to deteriorate. The state of emergency now extended. But we're also hearing from the UN that the healthcare system is near collapse.
The healthcare system is near collapse. People say they're having trouble finding food and water. Even Haitians that I've spoken to that were well stocked up ahead of this crisis say that those supplies are now beginning to run low. So it is certainly a crisis. You're seeing widespread looting. A key port terminal earlier today was looted by a crowd. ATMs have been looted and police stations have been burned. So while the government says the state of emergency is in place, a curfew is in place, you know, what practical that effect that has on the ground when the government doesn't control now most of the capital of Port-au-Prince or most of the country. In fact, you know, it's really hard to say. You know, this is a country where the prime minister is unable to return to. We've not heard anything really from Ariel Henry since he arrived in Puerto Rico after being in Kenya, where he negotiated a deal to bring in Kenyan soldiers, 1,000 Kenyan soldiers, and then was in the U.S. Having conversations with U.S. officials who have essentially tried to urge him to try to form a transitional government, you know, given to some of these gang leaders' demands that Henri begin to look towards the exit here and bring in a new government that potentially would call for elections. That's what the U.S. wants. You know, of course, these gang leaders are trying to protect their turf, the very lucrative drug trade and kidnapping trade and other illegal businesses. And they feel threatened by those Kenyan soldiers who were supposed to come in and try to restore order. But, you know, really no word on when they're due to arrive. And for Haitians, time is running out.
Yeah, it certainly is. Hopefully there is some sort of resolution sooner rather than later. Patrick Altman for us. Good to have you on the story. Thank you. Well, straight ahead, Beijing's top diplomat slamming the U.S. over trade and vowing to deepen ties with Russia. More from the National People's Congress coming up next. Plus, UNICEF says malnourished babies are dying in Gaza. We're going to speak to the Children's Agency about getting aid into the Palestinian territory.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life.
I'm a health reporter and have been for 15 years. And even I feel overwhelmed by some of the things I read about the stuff we're eating.
My colleague Meg Terrell wanted to take a deep dive into something you've probably heard a lot about recently. Ultra-processed foods. There is a lot to learn there, some fascinating stuff. And some of it is probably going to change the way you shop. Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to First Move. I'm Linda Kincaid, and a very good Friday morning to you if you are just waking up with us in Asia. Well, in today's money move, U.S. stocks rose for a second straight day, with the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ both hitting fresh record highs. All this on the eve of Friday's all-important U.S. jobs report. In Asia, Japanese stocks fell from their recent record highs, and Chinese stocks pulled back too, despite better-than-expected trade data there. China's foreign minister is now reiterating his country's right to defend itself in the South China Sea as tensions escalate in the region. Wang Yi's comments come after clashes between Chinese and Philippine vessels in recent months. And China's top diplomat was speaking at the National People's Congress in Beijing, where he was also slamming Washington's, quote, bewildering trade policies. Christy Lu Stout reports.
On the sidelines of the National People's Congress in Beijing, Foreign Minister Wang Yi accused the U.S. of suppressing China to the point of reaching, quote, bewildering levels of unfathomable absurdity. And Wang added that China opposes all acts of bullying. In questions with reporters on Thursday, Wang commented on the fractious U.S.-China relationship. He called for mutual respect. He acknowledged some improvement in relations since recent summits, but he also said this.
But it has to be pointed out that U.S. misperception toward China continues, and U.S. promises are not truly fulfilled. The U.S. has been devising various tactics to suppress China and kept lengthening its unilateral sanctions list, reaching bewildering levels of unfathomable absurdity.
The U.S. and China are at odds over an array of issues, including sanctions and access to technology, as well as territorial disputes in the South China Sea and Taiwan. Now, regarding the South China Sea, Wang said that China will take justified actions to defend its rights. He said China has been exercising a, quote, high degree of restraint, even after the Philippines accused Chinese vessels of dangerous maneuvers. This is something a CNN team witnessed this week in contested waters. Now, on Taiwan, Wang said that China will continue to strive for peaceful reunification. Now, Chinese leader Xi Jinping on Wednesday also called for peaceful reunification while rallying, quote, patriots to reunify China. According to state-run media, Xinhua, Xi urged a political group at the MPC to, quote, unite all patriots from home and abroad, in and out of Taiwan, to step up opposition against Taiwan independence, expand support for national reunification, and jointly advance the peaceful reunification of China, unquote. Xi is calling for peaceful reunification as China's economy is ailing. In a bid to boost tourism, China's foreign minister announced a visa exemption to six additional countries, including Switzerland, Ireland, Hungary, Austria, Belgium, and Luxembourg. This is on a pilot basis starting from March the 14th. The United States is not on the list. Christy Lu Stout, CNN, Hong Kong.
Well, it has been a snowy and rainy week for parts of Japan, but it's looking like there may be warmer times ahead. Elisa Raffer joins us now with more of the forecast, and no doubt with the cherry blossom season on their way, they are hoping for some spring weather soon.
Yeah, temperatures rebounding a little bit by the end of the week. But we do have another round of snow to get through in Japan, Linda, before that can happen. If you look at the satellite, you can see where we've had some showers over the last 12 hours across parts of Japan, but skies are clear over China. If you go ahead the next couple hours, you can see we have some moisture that comes across that Sea of Japan. It's colder air that comes across it too, so that's going to pump that sea effect snow. That colder air coming in, that's what's going to give you some snow showers for the western side there of Japan. We're looking at 30 to 45 centimeters there of snow. So definitely some decent amounts there being fueled by the ocean moisture and some of that colder air. 12 degrees with some showers in Osaka, 7 degrees in Tokyo with some rain and snow showers there, 7 degrees in Seoul as well. We have that cold air that's going to pump that snow, but it does start to moderate some and not be quite as cold by the end of the week. There's some warmer air to the south. out that tries to get in. So if you look for a place like Tokyo, where temperatures are below average on a Friday with some of those showers, you do get back up closer to average by the middle of, by the end of the week and going into next week. By Monday, Tuesday, you're back up to 13 degrees, which is closer to your average for this time of year. In the U.S., we're watching some severe thunderstorms. We have a severe thunderstorm watch stretching from parts of Kansas down into Texas. They're in the yellow as showers and storms really start to fire up. We're looking at the threat of large hail, damaging winds, and a tornado or two possible there in that yellow area through tonight and then again into tomorrow. You can see as the storm continues to move east, it packs some heavy rain as we go into Friday for a lot of the south, some torrential downpours, and some damaging wind gusts still possible. So we've got multiple days here of severe weather possible in the southern part of the U.S. with damaging winds, a couple of tornadoes, heavy rain too. We've already had some flooding conditions here in Atlanta over the last week, and that could continue to get worse as we pile on another 150 millimeters of rain by the end of the week. We've got some flood threat that we'll have to watch out for as we head into Friday. You see that kind of red moderate risk area from Atlanta down into Montgomery. That's where we can have some additional flooding possible as we head into the weekend.
Hopefully not too bad. I want some sunshine this weekend. Lisa, Rafa, good to have you with us. Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with much more news. Welcome back to First Move. I'm Linda Kincaid. Good to have you with us. I want to take a look at more of the international headlines this hour. Sweden is officially part of NATO. The country's prime minister handed over the final documents to the US State Department Thursday. It marked the long last step in a long process requiring sign-offs from each of the alliance's member states. Sweden has famously stayed neutral in many international conflicts, but Russia's invasion of Ukraine pushed it to join. Thousands of German workers are on strike, grounding planes, cancelling trains and shutting down the country's largest airport. Workers at Lufthansa have walked off the job, with the airline saying up to 9 in 10 flights could be impacted. A major union is asking for higher pay, blaming the high cost of living. A China Southern flight heading to Beijing was delayed for more than 4 hours after a passenger threw a handful of coins into the plane engine. And surprisingly, it's not the first time this has happened. China has seen multiple instances of passengers throwing coins at planes, including one elderly flyer who said it was for good luck. The UN is welcoming plans by the US to build a port in Gaza for the delivery of humanitarian aid. President Biden is set to announce the details during his State of the Union address. Well, UNICEF says right now humanitarian aid can't be delivered soon enough. And right now they're having problems with Israeli obstacles. As a result, children are dying of hunger. The agency is warning that malnutrition related to deaths in Gaza will skyrocket if the crisis isn't resolved. UNICEF spokesperson Ricardo Pires joins me now for more on this. Good to have you with us, Ricardo. So I want to ask you first about the US plans to ramp up the delivery of aid. We saw the third airdrop today, but now we're hearing about this plan to establish a temporary port in the sea off Gaza to deliver more aid. Has this been done before? What are you hearing about how this is going to work and how much aid it might be able to deliver?
Thanks for having me. At this point, any aid arriving to the desperate children and civilians in Gaza is very welcome. We've seen airdrops taking place recently, and now this potential operation via sea is indeed something that we're not very used to. But again, any support is needed right now and very welcome. But it's important to understand a little bit more the details of how this would work, what kind of aid will be delivered, how it will proceed from sea to land, and more importantly, where this aid is going to go. Is it going to be distributed safely with an appropriate logistic operation, for example, to people who have been isolated in the north of Gaza and children who are now dying of hunger? So how is that going to help the immediate needs of hundreds of thousands of children who are desperate in the strip right now and cannot wait any longer for any other solution than a ceasefire and more access to humanitarian supplies, which are much better done on ground than via the sky or even the sea?
But the issue, of course, Ricardo, is the problems getting it into Gaza via the ground channels, as we've seen it. And it seems quite insane, the amount of aid that's sitting even in warehouses in places like Jordan. We had a CNN investigation. I want to play a little bit of sound from that investigation by my colleague Nema Elbaga.
About 1,000 trucks worth of essential medical aid and food supplies meant for Gaza, collecting dust, waiting to be cleared by Israeli officials.
I mean, these are baby wipes.
Yes.
Why are you still waiting for permission on baby wipes?
I don't know.
Israel, of course, has been accused of using aid as a weapon to punish an entire population. What's your assessment of the issues at stake here, trying to get aid that is desperately needed into Gaza right now?
Well, I think it's very clear. Not enough aid is entering Gaza right now. It hasn't been entering Gaza since October 7th. Again, hundreds of thousands of children have been desperately waiting for more food, more water, more medical supplies to get in. And instead, what we're seeing is more bombardments, more violence, and no safe place for them to be. We've heard right now on the segment what some of the problems are, and indeed, long inspections and checkpoints are a huge part of it. Again, children are dying of starvation when 10 kilometers away, 30 kilometers away, there's aid that could save their lives not entering. So that is just unacceptable. It's been 4 months now since the onset of this horrendous war, and we just need a ceasefire, and we need any procedures that are required to get more aid in to be accelerated and to take place as soon as possible.
UNICEF, of course, helps children all over the world. How would you describe what the children of Gaza are experiencing right now? Because we are seeing the images of children not only injured and dying from bombs and shrapnel, but now starving.
That's a very good question and a tough one. I think they have been living a nightmare for at least 4 months now, for over 4 months. And I have colleagues from UNICEF who have been to Gaza and saw firsthand and spoke to families and children who've been injured and fighting for their lives in overcrowded hospitals in absolute desperation, and many times not even knowing that they also lost their parents or family members or loved ones, siblings. So it's unimaginable and very hard to describe that horror, but it's very, very real for hundreds of thousands of children who are now squeezed in a tiny strip of land in Rafah, some more in the north of Gaza, completely isolated from any aid getting in. So we can only summarize this as an absolute humanitarian catastrophe and a war on children that has been taking place for way too long.
Yeah, way too long, since October. But there is concern that it is going to get worse, given the fact that the ceasefire talks don't seem to be going anywhere right now. And we know that Israel has said it will launch an offensive in Rafah if they don't get a deal before Ramadan, which is later next week. What's your message to the people negotiating that will resume these negotiations next week?
Well, we need to look at the best interest of the civilian population of, again, at least 1 million children who live in the Gaza Strip today. So that's half the population of the Gaza Strip. So that needs to be first and foremost. Their well-being, their safety needs to be ahead of any other potential argument to continue this war. So we would ask and call for any parties in the conflict to refrain from any escalation and to indeed negotiate a ceasefire, because without that, more children will die. And as we've seen from different causes, from injuries to disease on the ground, 90% of children in Gaza today are suffering from one or more infectious diseases, including diarrhea and respiratory diseases. So it's an absolute catastrophe for children. And unless the bombs stop, unless the violence stops, and unless the guns are put down, this will only get worse, and will get worse very rapidly.
We appreciate what you and your team are doing. UNICEF spokesperson Ricardo Pires, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've got some news just into CNN. U.S. Army sergeant has been charged with leaking classified information to China in exchange for $42,000. I want to bring in our Oren Lieberman, who has the reporting from the Pentagon. Good to have you with us, Oren. So this was an intelligence analyst. What is he being charged with?
Well, the charges here include, and I'll read them off, conspiracy to obtain and disclose national defense information, exporting technical data related to defense articles without a license, conspiracy to export defense articles, and bribery. According to prosecutors, Sergeant Corbane Schultz was an intelligence analyst in the Army, where he had a top secret clearance and access to classified information. In fact, according to the indictment, the federal indictment, part of his job was teaching others how to handle classified information. But according to the indictment, prosecutors say that Schultz, in about June, July of 2022, began a relationship with someone identified as Conspirator A, who was purportedly living in Hong Kong, so a Chinese national. This began with Conspirator A asking for some classified information, some sensitive information, which prosecutors say Schultz then provided, and there was a first initial payment of about $200 in the summer of 2022. But soon thereafter, according to the indictment, Schultz wanted to expand this relationship, and he wanted to make it a long-term proposition. From there, prosecutors say the exchange of information continued, with the conspirator paying more information for classified and secret documents as opposed to just sensitive information. In payments of several thousand dollars here and there over the course of a period that started in July 2022 and went all the way to October 2023, prosecutors say Schultz received some $42,000 in exchange for the information. What was the information included, according to prosecutors? Sensitive data about tactics for the F-22, one of the U.S.'s most advanced fighter jets, information about the HIMARS rocket launcher system, information about the U-2 high-altitude reconnaissance aircraft, and much, much more. All of this detailed in the indictment here. Schultz is in custody at this point. There is no information about an attorney representing him, but it is worth noting this comes just a few days after another retired service member was arrested for leaking information. In that case, prosecutors say it was online through dating apps to someone who claimed to be a Ukrainian woman, specifically about information about Russia's war in Ukraine. So you can't say this is a trend based on two instances in 1 week, but Linda, certainly these cases back to back highlight that there is a major concern here about the leaking of classified information. And this comes, of course, after Massachusetts Air National Guardsman Jack Teixeira pleaded guilty to leaking classified information online just several days ago.
Yeah, incredible. Good to have your reporting on it. Oren Lieberman at the Pentagon, thanks very much. We are going to take a quick break. We have much more news coming up in just a moment. Stay with us. You're watching CNN.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. Celebrities of all kinds are speaking publicly about their therapeutic trips, so to speak. It turns out there is a burgeoning industry ready to serve the new influx of people who find themselves turning away from traditional mental health therapy. The gap between what we know and what we don't about psychedelic therapy. Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Well, nearly 2 years ago, a mass shooter killed 21 people at a school in Uvalde, Texas. And hours ago, there was anger at an independent investigator's report into the incident and the police response. The Justice Department released its own findings into what happened at Robb Elementary School in January. It said officers ran towards the sound of gunfire and froze once they got near the classrooms. Here's what the mother of one of the victims said to the investigator.
You said that it was best, that there was no way to go in. It was for their safety. It was not for the safety of children. How dare you? I know some of you. I have worked with some of you. Before I lost Lexi, and I am asking you to do what no one else has done yet, do the right thing. It is not about a recommendation. It's about doing the right thing. There were multiple law enforcement officers from multiple agencies that stood by for 77 minutes as children and teachers died. And I'm not going to stand by.
Shimon Prokopez is following the story again and joins us now. Good to have you with us. It's just heartbreaking, obviously, like hearing from the families again dealing with this. We know there were problems with the way the police responded to this, but now you're getting the results of this independent investigation. Take us through it.
Yeah, and this independent investigation, the conclusions of it, the findings of it, completely different than what anyone who's investigated this from the Department of Justice to the Texas Department of Public Safety has said. The Texas Department of Public Safety said that this was an abject failure on the part of law enforcement. The Department of Justice said that officers failed that day, that had they taken action, had they done what they were supposed to do, lives would have been saved. We got a completely different conclusion here today from this independent investigator. He said that the officers, there was no wrongdoing on their part, that there was no violation of policy, that in fact one of them even showed measurable strength, and that they all acted in good faith. And then he talked about how he exonerated all of these officers, the ones that he investigated. I try to catch up with him afterwards. His name is Jesse Prado. He's a 25-year veteran, paid some probably about $100,000, if not more, by the city to do this investigation. When we caught up with him outside, he didn't have much to say. Certainly he said a lot inside. He didn't have as much to say outside. Take a listen.
Do you feel the pain of these families and what happened here today? Or are you just not going to answer our questions?
Sir, I'm not going to answer at this point.
Why not? This is your opportunity to speak to us.
I'm not done with the job on their side. I'm done with the report, but they still have some questions that they need to ask.
Well, you left. You left, and you wouldn't answer their questions. You left. You left. Do you disagree with what the Department of Justice said?
What happened after he was done with his testimony at the city council hearing, he left. They let him answer some questions from the lawyer, the city attorney, and then he was excused. Kim Rubio, one of the mothers who you heard from at the top of the segment, she demanded that he return back to the room. They had to go outside and get him because she wanted him to sit there and face the families. He didn't want to. He left. He said what he had to say. He talked about how he exonerated officers, and then he walked out. And it was that parent who demanded that he come back, and that is why he ultimately came back. At one point even, a family member asked him to take off his hat. He's wearing a cowboy hat out of respect for the families, and he refused. And he just sat there as the families expressed their anger and frustration at him.
It's just horrific given what these families have already gone through, Shimon. This shooting, of course, happened 2 years ago. 19 children killed, 2 teachers. Their families obviously want accountability, but what's next for these families?
Accountability is getting harder and harder and harder, especially after this report. The city is going to rely on this report. They paid a lot of money for this report. They're going to use it as evidence of the fact that they can't discipline anyone. This gives them the ability now not to fire some of these officers, not to discipline any of these officers, because they have this report and they can say, look, this is what this man said. They did nothing wrong. And so for the families, that accountability that they're searching for, they want these officers gone. They don't want them on the streets of Uvalde anymore. And that just seems very unlikely. Now, one of the mothers was just shocked. She couldn't believe what was happening. Some of the city council members who were sitting there, I mean, their jaws were just almost on the ground. I mean, they were just shocked at what this man was saying. The other thing that's important to remember here is that there's a criminal investigation by the local district attorney. There's a grand jury investigation. Witnesses are going before the grand jury. There's not a lot of optimism here right now that anything's going to come of that. But the families will certainly at some point be able to go and speak to these grand jurors, and they'll wait and see what happens. But it just seems, you know, when things are starting to turn around for this community and they can maybe get some rest and maybe can move on, something like this happens today. And as Kim Rubio said, it's to this investigator when she was talking to him, you're kicking me while I'm down already. And that's how these family members feel today.
Yeah, it really does feel like that. It's just horrific. Shimon Porcupaz, we appreciate you covering this story from the get-go for the last couple of years. Thank you very much for your reporting. We are going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We'll talk about Stranger Things on Netflix. The streaming giant has just announced what will surely be one of the most talked about boxing matchups this year between former heavyweight champion Mike Tyson and internet star turned boxer Jake Paul. The difference in age between the two fighters is as big as the boxing ring. Tyson will be 58, Paul is only 27, and the match will take place in Texas on July 20th. Well, Patrick Snell is following the story and joins us now live here in Atlanta. I could have almost popped in here,
you
Patrick.
Could.
Good to see you. So it's exciting, but it's also amazing that Mike Tyson is literally stepping out of retirement for this match, the first ever live streamed boxing match. And the expectations are pretty high, right? Because they are expecting this to be the most watched boxing match in modern history.
I mean, it's going to be absolutely historic, no question. The hype is building up already. And look, it's not till July the 20th and we're still already talking about it. It's going to be taking place at the 80,000 seat capacity AT&T Stadium in Texas, home of the Dallas Cowboys, no less. Iron Mike Tyson, someone that I absolutely idolized back in the day for his fighting prowess, the former world heavyweight champ of the world, a fearsome competitor ever there was, an iconic legend of the sport and widely regarded as one of the best boxers, Linda, in history. But as you mentioned there in the setup, he's 57 years of age now, and he's up against 27-year-old Jake Paul, internet celebrity turned pro boxer. You mentioned the hype, but this is going to be big, big money as well for both men. It's going to be fascinating to see one of the most dangerous fighters in history in the ring once again. But Paul, you know, as well, is very interesting. He transitioned from YouTube, going on to win 9 of his 10 fights to date. His only defeat coming against Tommy Fury, the younger half-brother of heavyweight champ Tyson Fury. That was early last year. You really do sense, though, Paul wants to be taken seriously as a genuine lover of boxing. He wants that respect. He's worked very hard. I saw a statement from him earlier as well, Linda. Quote, "My sights are set on becoming a world champion. And now I have a chance to prove myself against the greatest heavyweight champ ever, the baddest man on the planet, and the most dangerous boxer of all time. This will be the fight of a lifetime." Linda, I'm already waiting and excitedly for this one. Back to you.
You can't wait for July for this match. But Patrick, we can't overstate the age gap, right? Mike Tyson, almost 60, almost 3 decades older than his opponent. Has he still got what it takes, and how is he going to prepare?
Well, that's the fascinating question. Look, you look at his social media and he just looks in robust, absolutely formidable, dare I say, ferocious shape. That's kind of scary for any opponent. But we should point out that Tyson last fought professionally in June of 2005. He boasts a 50-6 career record, 44 of his wins coming by way of knockout. Tyson now a member of the Sports Hall of Fame. He actually did come out of retirement, Linda, to face Roy Jones Jr. That was in an exhibition match, which ended in a somewhat controversial split draw. That was back 4 years ago now, in 2020. So what does Tyson himself say of Jake Paul? Well, Iron Mike saying that Paul, in his opinion, has grown significantly as a boxer over the years, adding, quote, "It'll be a lot of fun to see what the will and ambition of a kid can do with the experience and aptitude of a goat." That, of course, is greatest of all time. And I love this part, Linda. Tyson then saying, this is pretty ominous. Typical Mike, you might say. Tyson adding, "I started him on his boxing journey on the undercard of my fight with Roy Jones, and now I plan to finish him." Linda, I wonder if you had to pick a winner, who might it be?
I don't know. You want to go the legend Mike Tyson, surely, right?
I would think so. I wouldn't bet against him.
Is he the underdog because of his age? I don't know.
No, I don't think he is, but that's just my opinion. Yeah, well, it's just fascinating, the build-up. They wanted us to be talking about it several weeks out, and we are. Several months out. Yeah.
Yeah, the Netflix is going to do well at it, I'm sure. And no doubt they're going to be paid a pretty penny. Patrick Snell, good to see you. Thanks so much. That wraps our show. I'm Linda Kincaid. Thanks for joining us. I'll see you tomorrow, same time.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, host of the Chasing Life podcast. In honor of our 10th season, we want to hear from you. Leave us a message at 470-396-0832. And tell us how you chase life. It could be used on an upcoming episode.